Chapter 63. Lars. The guests of Tranquillum House stood in a huddled, whispering group in the center of the studio, their heads bent, like a cluster of banished smokers outside their office on a chilly day. Lars could smell acrid sweat and stale breath. Ben and Jessica held hands. Carmel and Francis both chewed at their fingernails. Tony tugged aggressively at his bottom lip, as if he could somehow contort his mouth into providing the correct answers, while Zoe kneaded her stomach and studied her feet, and her parents both studied her. "I'm sure Yao is fine, don't you think? And Delilah? There is no way Marcia would really hurt anyone," said Frances. "No way in the world. She sees herself as a healer." Lars could tell Frances was trying to convince herself. The longer they were in here, the more stripped back she got. Her red lipstick was gone, and her blonde hair, which had been in a bouncy circa 1995 ponytail, was now slicked back against her head. Lars liked Frances, but she wasn't the lawyer he would have retained, given a choice, if he were on death row. He didn't know who he would have chosen out of this motley lot. He wasn't sure how much it really mattered. Marcia was going to do what she was going to do. "We just need to make it look as if we're going along with the madness," said Lars. "I agree," said Napoleon. "We have to play along and take the first opportunity we can to find a way out of here."
"I believed in her," said Carmel sadly. "I believed in this." She indicated her surroundings. "I thought I was being transformed."
"So I'm representing you," said Francis to Lars anxiously. "We need to talk." "God, I would do anything for a pen." "Well, supposedly I'm representing you, Francis, in this grotesque game," sighed Heather. "So I guess we need to talk too."
"Okay, yes, yes, but just let me talk to my client first," said Frances, breathing fast.
She put a hand to her chest to try to calm herself. Lars smiled at her. She would be the sort to play a game of charades with endearing seriousness and little skill, as if it were a matter of life and death. And now that it truly might be a matter of life and death, surely not. She was in danger of hyperventilating.
"Let's go and have a chat, Francis," said Lars soothingly, "and then you can go convince Heather why you should live."
"This is pathetic," said Heather, as they split up into pairs.
"We're an odd number," said Napoleon. "I'll wait for my turn."
He lowered his voice even further. "I'll just keep looking around for a way out of here." He wandered off, his hands shoved in the pockets of his dad's shorts. Lars and Francis went to sit in a corner.
"Right."
Francis sat cross-legged in front of Lars. She frowned intensely.
"Tell me everything about your life, your relationships, your family."
"Tell her I'm a philanthropist. I do a lot of things for the community."
"Volunteer work."
"Do you?" interrupted Francis. "You write fiction," said Lars.
"Let's just make it up.
It doesn't actually matter what you say as long as it looks like we're going along with the exercise." Frances shook her head. That woman might be crazy, but she can smell insincerity a mile off. I'm going along with the exercise, and I'm doing it properly. You tell me everything, Lars, right now. I'm not kidding. Lars groaned. He ran his fingers through his hair. I help women, he said. I only represent women in divorce cases. Seriously? Said Frances. Isn't that discriminatory? I get my clients by word of mouth, said Lars. They all know each other, these types of women. They play tennis together. So you only represent wealthy women, said Frances. I'm not doing it for love, said Lars. I make good money. I just make sure a certain type of man pays a fair price for his sins. Frances tapped her thumbnail against her front teeth like an imaginary pen. Are you in a relationship? Yes, said Lars. We've been together for 15 years. His name is Ray, and he would probably prefer I wasn't sentenced to death. He felt a sudden burst of longing for Ray, and for home, for music, and the sizzle of garlic, for Sunday mornings. He was done with health resorts. When he got out of here, he was going to book a holiday for him and Ray, a gastronomic tour of Europe. The man had got too skinny. His eyes looked huge in his face, all that obsessive bike riding. Legs spinning in a blur, up and down the hills of Sydney, faster and faster, trying to get those endorphins flooding his body, trying to forget that he was in a relationship where he gave more than he got. He's a good person, said Lars, and he was surprised to find himself close to tears, because it occurred to him that if he were to die, Ray would be snatched up like a too-good-to-be-true deal at the supermarket, and someone else could very easily love him the way he deserved to be loved. Poor Ray, murmured Frances, as if she knew what he was thinking. Why do you say that? Said Lars. Oh, it's just that you're so good-looking. I was briefly in love with a handsome man in my youth, and it was awful. And you're just, she jested at him, ridiculous. That's kind of offensive, said Lars. There was a lot of prejudice against people who looked like him. People had no idea. Yeah, get over it, said Frances. So, no kids? No kids, said Lars. Ray wants children. I don't. I never wanted children either, said Frances. Lars thought of Ray's mother at Ray's 35th birthday last month. As usual, she'd had one too many glasses of champagne, which meant she'd had two glasses. Can't you let him have one baby, Lars? Just one itsy-bitsy baby. You wouldn't have to lift a finger, I promise. Did your psychedelic therapy give you any special insights into your life? Asked Frances. Marcia would probably like it if I mentioned that. Lars thought about last night. Some parts had been spectacular. At one point, he realized he could see the music coming through his headphones in waves of iridescent color. He and Marcia had talked, but he didn't think there had been any particular insights. He'd told her at length about the colour of the music, and he felt like she might have got bored, which he'd found insulting, because he'd been speaking very eloquently and poetically. He didn't think he'd told Marcia about the little boy who kept appearing in his hallucinations last night. She would have liked that. He knew that the dark-haired, dirty-faced kid who kept grabbing Lars's hand was there to remind Lars of something significant and traumatic from his childhood. One of those formative memories that therapists were always so excited about dredging up. He had refused to go with the young Lars. "I'm busy," he kept telling him, as he lay back down on a beach to enjoy the colours of the music. "Ask someone else." "I don't care what my subconscious is trying to tell me. Thanks anyway." At one point in the night, he got into a conversation with Delilah that didn't feel therapeutic, more like shooting the breeze. In fact, he was pretty sure he could feel a sea breeze while they chatted. Delilah said, "You're just like me, Lars. You don't give a shit, do you? You just don't care." Did she have a cigarette in her hand at that point? Surely not. "What do you mean?" Lars had said lazily. "You know what I mean," Delilah said. She'd sounded so sure of herself, as if she knew Lars better than he knew himself. Frances banged her knuckles in rapid motion against her cheekbones. "Stop hitting yourself," said Lars. Frances dropped her hand. "I've never represented anyone in court before," she said. "This isn't court," he said. "This is just a silly game." He looked over at Jessica, supposedly pregnant. "Tell Marcia that my partner and I are planning to have a baby," he said flippantly. "We can't lie," said Frances. She was clearly exasperated with him, poor woman. The expression on her face made him think of Ray, when Lars had done something to annoy or frustrate him. The compressed lips, the resigned slump of his shoulders, those disappointed eyes. He remembered the impish face of that little boy from last night and realized with a start that it wasn't his younger self at all. The kid had hazel eyes. Ray's eyes. Ray and his sister and mother all had the same eyes, eyes that made Lars want to close his own because of all that terrifying love and trust and loyalty. "Tell Marcia, if I don't live, I'll take out a wrongful death lawsuit against her," Lars told Frances. "I'll win. I guarantee you I'll win." "What?" Frances frowned. "That doesn't even make sense." "None of this makes sense," said Lars. "None of it." He saw again the dark-haired little boy with the hazel eyes, felt the tug of his hand, and heard his insistent voice. "I've got something to show you." Chapter 64. Jessica. Jessica and Zoe sat opposite each other, cross-legged, on a yoga mat, as if they were about to do a joint Pilates exercise. Jessica would have given anything to be in a Pilates class right now. Even the cheap one she did before they won the money, in that drafty community hall with all the local mums. Do you think this is, I don't know, serious? Zoe's eyes darted over to her parents and back. Jessica couldn't help but notice Zoe had great natural eyebrows.
Yeah, I kind of do, Jessica answered. I feel like Marcia is, like, totally capable of anything. She seems very unstable.
She tried to control her breathing. The fear kept rising and then receding in her stomach, like bouts of nausea on an amusement park ride. She wouldn't really, like, execute anyone, of course, said Zoe, smiling fiercely, as if determined to show she was making a joke.
Of course not, said Jessica.
But how did she know what this woman could do? She'd given them drugs without their consent, and who knew what she'd done to Yao and Delilah?
It's an exercise, that's all, to make us think. It's just a really stupid exercise.
I'm worried my mother might antagonize Marcia. She's not taking it seriously enough. Zoe shot a look at Heather.
Don't worry, I'll do a really good job defending her, said Jessica. Your mother is a midwife. She helps bring new life into the world. Also, I was on the debating team. First speaker. Jessica is a conscientious student. That was the comment she used to see most often on her report cards.
And I'll do a good job defending you. Zoe sat up straighter, with the air of a fellow conscientious student.
So, okay, I thought, first of all, I should obviously mention your pregnancy, right? You can't execute a pregnant woman. That would be against some convention or something, right?
That's true, said Jessica doubtfully, although she wasn't sure why she felt doubtful.
Was it because the pregnancy wasn't confirmed? Because it seemed like that was exploiting a loophole?
She only deserved to live because her innocent child deserved to live?
And if she wasn't pregnant, why should she live? Just because she really wanted to live? Because her parents loved her? Because she knew her sister loved her too, even if they were currently estranged? Because her Instagram followers often said she made their day? Because last financial year her charitable donations were higher than what had once been her annual income?
When we won the money, we really tried to, you know, not be selfish, she told Zoe, to share it, to give to charity. She ran her fingers through her hair like a comb and lowered her voice. But we didn't give it all away.
No one would expect that, said Zoe. It was your prize.
That's one thing I miss about our old life, admitted Jessica. Before we got rich, we didn't ever have to think about whether we were good people, because we didn't have time to be good. We were just paying the bills, getting by, living our lives. It was kind of easier.
She winced. That makes it sound like I'm complaining, and I promise you, I'm not.
I've read about lottery winners who go on crazy spending sprees and their relationships end and they lose the lot and end up on the dole, said Zoe.
I know, said Jessica. When we won, I did a lot of research about lottery winners, so I, like, knew the pitfalls. I reckon you've done a good job of it, said Zoe.
Thank you, said Jessica gratefully, because sometimes she had longed for someone to give her a good mark for how well she'd handled the prize money. She'd tried so hard to be a well-behaved lottery winner, to invest properly, to share appropriately, to get tax advice, to go to posh fundraiser balls where terrifyingly elegant people sipped French champagne while they bid obscene amounts of money on obscure items at charity auctions. All for a good cause, ladies and gentlemen.
She thought of Ben tugging at his bow tie, muttering, "Who the fuck are these people?" Should she have spent more at those charity balls? Less? Not gone at all? Sent a check? What would have made her a better person, more deserving of life right now? If this had happened before the win, what would Zoe have said? Jessica deserves to live because she works really hard at her boring as batshit job and she's never even flown business class in her life, let alone first class. So what sort of life is that? The money defined her now. She didn't even know who she was before the money. Ben didn't want to make any decisions except for which car to buy, she told Zoe. He didn't want anything to change. And that's just not possible. She touched her lips and looked down at her boobs, which were objectively awesome. Would her defense case be better if she didn't look like this? If she hadn't spent so much money on her body? Why would you want to look like one of those dreadful Kardashians? Her mother had once asked her. Because Jessica thought those dreadful Kardashians were stunning. It was her prerogative to think so. Before the money, Ben had drooled over images of luxury cars, and Jessica had drooled over pictures of models and reality stars that were maybe photoshopped, but she didn't care. He got his car, she got her body. Why was her new body more superficial than his new car? Sorry. She looked back up at Zoe and remembered that this girl's brother had committed suicide. Zoe had probably never met anyone as superficial as Jessica in her life. None of that helps you build my case, does it? Why should this girl live? Ah, because she tried really hard when she won the lottery. Zoe didn't smile, but gave Jessica a very serious, focused look. Don't worry. I can put a good spin on this. She looked up at the television screen where Marcia's face had loomed. What do you think will happen next? After we've played her stupid game?
I don't know, said Jessica honestly. It feels like anything could happen.
Chapter 65 Marcia collected a cushion from the lavender room. Yao made no sound as she lifted his head from her desk and slid the cushion beneath his cheek. His fluttering eyelids were not fully closed, revealing the shimmery slivers of his eyes. She remembered adjusting a blanket around a small sleeping form. It felt like a memory that belonged to someone else, although she knew it was hers. The memory had no texture to it, no smell or color. It was like the scenes from the security cameras around the building. That was not correct. She could give the memory color and texture if she so chose. The blanket was yellow. The smell was no more tears, baby shampoo. The sound was the tinkling tune of the Brahms lullaby as a mobile with dangling toys turned in slow circles. The touch was of soft, warm skin beneath her fingertips. But she did not choose to remember that right at this moment. She switched off the monitor so she could no longer see or hear her guests. She needed a break from them. The pitch of their voices was like fingernails on a blackboard. The sedative she'd given the owl was one they'd prepared in case a guest had a bad reaction to yesterday's smoothies and became so violent or agitated as to be a danger to themselves or others. Masha understood that the owl would sleep for a few restful hours and then he'd be fine. It was Yao himself who had taught both Masha and Delilah how to administer the injection in the event of an emergency. This had not been planned, but it had become clear to her that Yao's loss of confidence in the protocol was a serious liability. He needed to be temporarily removed from the strategic decision-making process. She'd needed to act fast, and she had, in the same way that she had once culled non-performing staff or even entire divisions. Her ability to make swift decisions and execute those decisions in the face of change had been one of her strengths throughout her working life. Agility. That's what it was. She was both metaphorically and literally agile. But once Yao slept, she felt oddly alone. She missed him. She missed Delilah, too. Without Yao or Delilah here, there was no one to mentor, no one observing her actions, no one to whom she needed to explain herself. It was strange. She had lived alone for large chunks of her life. When she was renovating Tranquillum House and creating and refining the personal development plan that resulted in her incredible physical and spiritual transformation, she had spent months at a time without seeing a soul, and she had not felt the loss of company at all. But her life was different now. She was rarely alone. There were always people in the house. Her staff, her guests. This reliance on people was a weakness. She needed to work on that. She was a work in progress. Nothing stays the same. It was a hypothetical exercise she had set for the guests, but their fear needed to be real. She had not seen enough fear. She had seen cynicism and doubt. These people were disrespectful, ungrateful, quite unintelligent, to be frank. Those drugs weren't cheap. They had cut into her profit margins. She had been prepared to take less profit for their benefit. Dear Yao had worked so hard to ensure the correct dosages for each guest. There had been many late nights getting this right. The new protocol was meant to be Masha's career pivot. She was ready to be part of a bigger world again. She missed the public recognition she had enjoyed in her corporate life, the profiles in business magazines, the invitations to deliver keynote addresses.
She wanted to publish articles and deliver speeches at conferences and events. She had already put the word out about a potential book deal. The response had been positive. "Personal transformation is a topic of perennial interest," wrote one publisher. "Keep us posted." Masha had enjoyed the thought of her previous colleague seeing her reincarnation. They would probably not recognize her at first, and then they would respond with awe and envy. She had escaped the rat race, and look what she had achieved. There would be magazine profiles and television interviews. She planned to employ a publicist. She certainly intended to mention Yao in the acknowledgments of her book and would even consider promoting him to a more senior position at Tranquillum House while she was busy on the speaking circuit. Masha's glittering, glorious future lay ahead, and these ungrateful dolts stood in the way of it. Masha had anticipated year-long waiting lists after the news of their success got out. Prices would have to rise to reflect the demand. These people had been offered this incredible program for a bargain basement price, and they did nothing but moan. They thought they were hungry. Had they ever known true hunger? Had they ever lined up for more than 5 minutes to buy basic food supplies? Masha considered the blank computer monitor and thought about turning it back on, but she didn't want to see them right now. She was too angry with them. That Heather McConey was so disrespectful. Masha did not like her. If any one of them had a brain, they could be out of that room right now and on their way to the police to make their complaints about how poorly they had been treated, when the truth was they had been lovingly nurtured. Masha took a key from her top drawer and unlocked the cupboard beneath her desk. For a moment, she sat and studied the contents. Her mouth filled with saliva. She lunged forward and grabbed a bag of Doritos and a jar of salsa. The bag was fat and smooth and crackled in her hand. She remembered the woman who had come home late at night from the office after working a 16-hour day and sit in a dark room in front of the television to mindlessly eat Doritos and salsa. That had been Masha's evening meal. She had not cared about her body. Her body meant nothing. She just bought bigger and bigger-sized clothes when she noticed. All she cared about was work. She smoked and did no exercise. As that doctor had said, she was a heart attack or a stroke waiting to happen. She opened the pack and breathed in the scents of fake cheese and salt. Her mouth watered. Her stomach churned with self-disgust. It had been over a year since she had last indulged in this depraved, disgusting act. This was all because of her ungrateful guests. Last time she ate Doritos, it had also been a guest's fault. He had put a 1-star review on TripAdvisor about Tranquillum House and written a litany of lies. He said they had bed bugs. He posted a photo of the bites. There were no bed bugs. He made it all up because Masha told him on the last day that he was a candidate for a heart attack or a stroke unless he committed to change his lifestyle when he got back home. She knew this was because she recognized him as the person she had once been. Yet, she offended him by using the word fat. He was fat. Why the surprise? Wasn't that why he came here? Masha put the first Dorito on her tongue, and her whole body trembled with the chemical reaction it invoked. She knew exactly how many calories she was about to consume and how much exercise she was going to need to do to burn them off. Alternatively, she could vomit. She crunched the Dorito between her teeth and opened the jar of salsa with one hard twist of her wrist. Once, she had weak, useless arms that would have struggled to open this jar. That sad, fat woman in front of the television used to swear and tap away at the lid with a spoon, trying to loosen it. In the life before that, there had been a man for opening jars. She used to call for her husband sharply, like he was a servant, and he would open the jar, smile, and touch her. He was always touching her. Every single day, for years and years, she was touched. But that was someone else. It had been decades now since she was touched with love. She thought briefly of Yao's hand tonight, touching hers, and she took another Dorito from the pack and scooped out the red, glistening salsa. Yao made a tiny sound like a child. His cheeks were flushed. He looked like a feverish baby. Masha put the back of her hand to his forehead and held it there for a moment. He did feel hot. She shoved the Dorito in her mouth and began to eat faster and faster, yellow crumbs falling all over her desk and her dress as she allowed herself to remember the last day of that life of so long ago. It was a Sunday. Her ex-husband was out being a laid-back Australian. Australians liked to call themselves laid-back, as if that were a good thing. He had accepted an invitation from his work colleagues to play a game where they shot each other with balls of paint. It would be fun and a lot of laughs. Yes, it sounded very laid back, running around shooting each other. The other wives were going, but Masha stayed home with the baby. She had nothing in common with those women, and they dressed so badly it made her depressed and homesick. Masha was a working mother. She had work to do. She was 10 times smarter than all the men at the company where she worked, but she had to work 10 times harder for the recognition she deserved. She was too tall. Sometimes her colleagues pretended not to understand her, and sometimes she could tell they really didn't understand, even though she spoke better English than them. She didn't appreciate their humor. She never laughed on time, and they didn't appreciate hers. When she made a joke, often a very funny, sophisticated, intelligent joke, they stared at her with confused, blank faces. At home, she had many friends, but here she experienced a strange kind of shyness.
It made her angry and resentful to feel that way, because back home she would never have been called shy. She held herself stiffly because she could not stand to be laughed at. And here there was always the possibility that she might misunderstand or be misunderstood. Her husband didn't care when that happened. He found it funny. He had fearlessly dived straight into the social scene before he knew the rules, and people loved him. Masha was proud of him for that, although also a little envious. Once, Masha and her husband were invited to her boss's home for what Masha assumed was a dinner party. She dressed very nicely, very sexy, high heels and a dress. Every single woman but Masha wore jeans. The invitation said, "Bring your own meat." Masha confidently told her husband, "No, no, that is a joke, an Australian joke. Not very funny, but most definitely a joke." They would not make the embarrassing mistake of taking it seriously. But it was not a joke. The women in jeans carried plastic shopping bags looped over their hands. The bags contained packages of uncooked meat. Just enough for two. Two steaks. Four sausages. Masha could not believe her eyes. Her husband was quick. He slapped his hand to his forehead. "Oh, no, we left our meat at home," he told the host. "No worries," said the host. "We've got plenty to spare." So generous of him to spare a little meat for the guests he'd invited to his home. The moment they walked through the front door, women and men split into different groups, as if they were banned from talking to each other. The men stood around a barbecue overcooking the meat for what seemed like hours. The food was inedible. There were no chairs. People sat anywhere. Three women sat on a retaining wall. After that day, Masha decided not to concern herself with establishing a social circle in Sydney. What was the point? She had an 11-month-old baby and a demanding full-time job and a husband. Her life was busy and satisfying, and she was truly happy, happier than she had ever been in her life. It was gratifying to have a baby so clearly superior to other babies in terms of both beauty and intelligence. This was an objective fact. Her husband agreed. Sometimes she felt sorry for other mothers when they saw her baby sitting so dignified and upright in his stroller, his fair hair shining in the sun. So many other babies were bald, like old men. His little head swiveling from side to side as he observed the world with his big green eyes. When he found something funny, as he often did, he got that from his father, he chuckled right from his belly, surprisingly deep, and everyone in hearing distance had to laugh too. And at that moment, as Masha exchanged smiles with those around her, real smiles, not polite smiles. She wasn't isolated at all. She was a Sydneysider, a mother out with her child. That Sunday, she had nearly finished her work when the baby woke up. He no longer cried when he woke up. Instead, he made a musical, "Ah!" sound, as if he was playing with his voice. He let the sound go up and down, up and down.
He was as happily tone-deaf as his father singing as he stirred a pot on the stove. At one point, he called out, "Mama! Mama!" He was so smart. Many children of that age did not have a single word in their vocabulary. "I'm coming, my Lapochka," she called back. She only needed 5 minutes more, and she would be done. He became quiet again. She finished what she was doing. It took less than 5 minutes. Maybe 4. "Did you get tired of waiting for me, little bunny?" she said, as she opened the door of his bedroom. She thought he might have fallen back asleep. He was already dead. He'd strangled himself, playing with a long white cord from the window blind. It was not an uncommon accident, she later learned. Other women had seen what she saw that day. Their trembling fingers had untangled their precious babies. These days there were warning tags on blind cords. Masha always saw them when she walked into a room, even from very far away. Her husband said it was an accident and there was nothing to forgive as he stood at the hospital wearing the paint-splattered overalls from his game. She remembered the fine spray of blue dots across his jaw, like blue rain. She remembered also one strange moment when she had looked at the strangers all around her and wanted her mother. A woman who had never really liked Masha, let alone loved her, and who would provide no comfort. Yet, for just one moment in her grief, Masha had craved her presence. She refused her husband's forgiveness. Her son called for her, and she did not go to him. It was unacceptable. She let her husband go. She insisted he find another life, and he did eventually, although it took much, much longer than Masha wanted. It was such a relief when he was gone, when she no longer had to experience the pain of seeing the face that so resembled that of their beautiful son. Although she refused to read the emails he sent and wanted to know nothing about him, she accidentally discovered many years ago when she came across a man in a food court who was still friends with her husband, a man who was there on the day they shot the balls of paint, that her husband was healthy and happy, that he had married an Australian girl and had 3 sons. Masha hoped that he still sang when he cooked. She thought that he probably did. In her research, she had read of the hedonic treadmill theory, which said that people return to a certain preset level of happiness, regardless of what happened to them, whether it was very good or very bad. Her husband had been a simple, happy man, whereas Masha was a complex, unhappy woman. Masha's son would have been 28 this August. She probably would have had a difficult relationship with him if he had lived. They probably would have fought like Masha had once fought with her mother. Instead, he would always be her singing, chuckling baby, and a beautiful young man wearing a baseball cap walking towards her through a lake of color. She should have been allowed to stay with him.
Masha looked at the empty bag of Doritos. Her fingertips were stained yellow, the way her father's had once been stained by nicotine. She ran the heels of her hands over her mouth and turned the monitor back on to observe her guests. They were all awake, she saw. They sat in small groups, chatting in that laid-back Australian way. They were too relaxed. This was no dark night of the soul. It could have been a barbecue. These people did not truly believe they were facing death sentences. Never once had a member of staff defied her the way these people were defying her. The screen of her monitor pulsed as if it were alive. Was there some sort of malfunction? She put her finger to it and felt it quiver like a dying fish. She was momentarily confused before she remembered she had earlier taken 75 milligrams of LSD to improve her decision-making and mental clarity. This was simply a hallucination. She needed to relax and allow her brain to find all the right connections. She looked around the room and noticed a vacuum cleaner sitting quietly in the corner of her office. It was not pulsating. It was quite real. She had just not noticed it before. The cleaners must have left it. They had excellent cleaners here. She only recruited and employed the best. It was important to maintain quality standards at all levels of your business. There was something so familiar about the vacuum cleaner. Oh, she said, for her father was picking up the vacuum cleaner, clumsily, with both hands. It was such a cumbersome thing. He walked towards the door with it. No, 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 she screamed. Papochka, put it down. Do not go. But he looked back at her sadly and smiled, and he was gone. And no man would ever love her the way her father had loved her. He was not real. She knew this. It was very easy to see what was real and what was not. Her mind was very sharp, sharp enough to differentiate. She closed her eyes. Her baby's voice was calling for her. No, not real. She opened her eyes. And he was crawling across her office floor, babbling nonsense to himself. She closed her eyes quickly. No, not real. She opened her eyes. A cigarette would calm her. She opened her secret cupboard once more and removed an unopened packet of cigarettes and a lighter. The geometry of the pack enthralled her. Each of its four mathematically aligned angles was so pleasing. She opened the pack, removed a cigarette, and rolled its cylindrical shape back and forth between her fingertips. The lighter was orange, a color of such depth and beauty, it astonished her. She ran her thumb across the tiny, rough-edged wheel of the lighter. A gold flame burst forth, instantly and obediently. She let it go. And did it again. The lighter was a miniature factory, producing perfect flames on demand. There was such beauty in the efficient production of goods and services. A thought of crystalline clarity. Masha should forget the wellness industry completely and return to the corporate world. Forget pivoting. She should jump. It would simply be a matter of reactivating her LinkedIn account, and within a very short time, she would be headhunted, fielding offers. The boy in the baseball cap sat on the other side of her desk, dripping puddles of iridescent color all over her floor.
"What do you think?" she asked him. "Should I do that?"
He didn't speak, but she could tell he thought it was a good idea.
No more entitled, ungrateful guests. She would once again conduct multiple departments of a company, like an orchestra. Accounting, payroll, sales and marketing. It was all coming back to her, the glorious, unassailable solidity of a documented reporting structure with her name at the top. She would microdose daily to optimize her productivity. Ideally, her staff would do the same, although the people in HR would have all sorts of objections. She had begun a new life when she emigrated, when her son died, and again when her heart stopped. She could do it again. Sell this property and buy an apartment in the city. Or she studied the tiny flickering flame. The answer was right there.
Chapter 66. Ben.
"So, Napoleon, I've got you," said Ben, walking next to the older man as he strode up and down the length of the cellar. "I mean, I'm defending you." He felt like he should call him Mr. Marconi, or Sir. He had that teacherish manner, the sort of teacher you still wanted to impress even after you'd left school and bumped into him at the shops, looking startlingly short. Not that he could imagine Napoleon ever looking short.
"Thank you, Ben," said Napoleon, as if Ben had been given a choice.
"So, okay," said Ben. He rubbed his stomach. He had never been so hungry in his life. "I guess it's pretty simple why you deserve a stay of execution. You're a husband and a father and, well, I hope it's okay to include this in my speech, but your wife and daughter have already lost enough, haven't they? They couldn't lose you too."
"You can say that if you like," Napoleon smiled sadly.
"That's true."
"And you're a teacher," said Ben, "so kids depend on you."
"They do."
"Yep."
Napoleon rapped his knuckles on the brickwork. Ben had seen him do this 100 times since they'd been down here, as if he were hoping that he'd find a loose brick that would give them a way out. Ben knew it was hopeless. There was no way out of here except that door.
"Anything else I should say?" asked Ben, and his voice cracked.
When he'd had to deliver the toast at Pete's wedding, he thought he might pass out. And now it was his job to defend this man's life? Napoleon turned away from the wall and looked at Ben.
"Mate, I don't think it matters what you say. I wouldn't take it too seriously."
He clapped him on the shoulder.
"I think we need to take Marcia seriously, but not the game itself."
"You've got yourself a dud defense lawyer here," confessed Ben. "I got lucky. Lars is defending me, and he's appeared in court."
When Lars had his meeting with Ben, he only asked 2 or 3 quick questions before he said, "How about this?"
And then he launched into an eloquent speech, like something on television, all about how Ben was a morally upstanding young man on the very cusp of adulthood, about to become a father, deeply committed to his marriage, with so much to give to his wife, his family, his community, and so on and so forth. It all just flowed out, without a single or ah.
"Think that'll do the trick?" he asked at the end.
"Sure," marveled Ben. And then Lars had gone off to the bathroom to fix his hair in preparation for his appearance.
"I get so terrified of public speaking, I can't even breathe," Ben told Napoleon.
"Do you know, the only difference between fear and excitement is the exhalation?" asked Napoleon. "When you're afraid, you hold the air in the top part of the lungs. You need to exhale like this." He put his hand to his chest and demonstrated with a long, slow breath out. "Like that sound people make after a firework explodes." Ben did it with him.
"That's it," said Napoleon. "Tell you what, I'll go first. I'm defending Tony, so I'll bore Marsha to death speaking about his football career. I plan to do a rundown of every game he played. That'll show her." He stopped at the beam near the inscribed brick in the wall. "You saw this? The convict graffiti?" Delilah had shown it to them on their first tour of the house. Ben and Jessica hadn't really been that interested. Napoleon grinned. "Fascinating, eh? I read up on the history of this place before we came. These brothers eventually got their tickets of leave and ended up becoming very respectable, highly sought-after stonemasons. Far more successful than they would have been back home in England. They've got thousands of descendants in this area. When they were sentenced to be transported to Australia, I bet they were devastated. They probably felt like it was the end of the world. But it turned out to be the making of them. The lowest point of your life can lead to the highest. I just find that so..." For a moment he looked profoundly sad. "Interesting." Ben didn't know why he suddenly felt in danger of crying. It must be hunger. It occurred to him that when he got home, he owed his dad a visit. Just because his dad had given up on Lucy didn't mean Ben should give up on him. Ben put his fingers to the inscription. He thought about how everyone said it was such fantastic luck that he and Jessica won the lottery. But sometimes it didn't feel that way. He looked over at Jessica. Was he really going to be a dad himself? How could he advise a kid on how to live his life when he hadn't yet worked it out himself?
"Remember the exhale, mate," said Napoleon. "Just breathe out the fear."
Chapter 67. Heather.
"I'm quite a good friend," said Frances to Heather. "You could mention that."
She chewed a fingernail.
"I remember birthdays."
"I'm hopeless at birthdays," said Heather. In reality, she was hopeless at friends, and after Zach died, she could see no point to them at all. Friends were an indulgence. Frances winced. "I did totally forget a good friend's birthday this year, but that was because I was caught up in this internet scam, and I was so distracted that day,
And then it got to midnight and I thought, oh my God, Monica. But it was too late to text. So what about your family? Heather interrupted before she heard this Monica's life story. She found Francis to be quite flaky. Do you have family? Heather looked over Francis's shoulder at her own family. Zoe was sitting with Jessica, their heads bowed close, as if they were two friends sharing secrets. Napoleon and Ben walked as they talked, Ben listening intently and nodding respectfully, like he was one of Napoleon's best students. She didn't know what was going on with Napoleon right now. It was like an imposter was doing an excellent job performing the role of Napoleon. He was saying and doing all the right things and nearly getting away with it, but there was something just not quite right. Yes, said Francis, I have family. She looked uncertain. I guess I'm not that close to my immediate family. My father died and my mother remarried and moved overseas, the south of France. I have a sister, but she has a lot on her plate. Their day-to-day lives wouldn't be impacted that much if I was gone. Of course their lives would be impacted, said Heather. Well, Francis gave the blank screen a nervous look. I'm not saying they'd dance on my grave. Heather looked at her, surprised. The woman looked genuinely frightened. You do know you're not really on death row, don't you? This is just a stupid power game for that maniac. Shh, hissed Francis. She could be listening. I don't care, said Heather recklessly. I'm not scared of her. I kind of think you should be. Francis shot another uneasy look at the screen. It's fine. I'm going to play along, said Heather, to comfort the poor woman. I don't think you should be executed. Thanks so much, said Francis. So what else should I say? Appeal to her ego, said Francis. Start out by saying that it's true that Francis's life didn't mean all that much until this point. But now she has done this retreat, she has been rehabilitated. Rehabilitated, said Heather. That's right. Francis was as jittery as a junkie. Make sure you use the word rehabilitated. I think she'll like that. Make it clear that I've seen the error of my self-indulgent ways. I'm going to exercise, eat clean, no more preservatives. I'm going to set goals. Good morning, my sweetie pies. Marcia's voice boomed through the room as her image flickered to life once more on the screen. Frances gasped and swore, clutching Heather's arm. It is time, cried Marcia. She took a long, deep drag of a cigarette and blew the smoke out the side of her mouth. It is time to play death sentence. Wait. We're not calling it that, are we? It is time to play Death Row. A much better name. Who thought of that name? But it's not time yet. Napoleon looked at his watch. Heather stared at the screen. Marcia was smoking. She didn't know why she was so surprised after everything else that had happened, but it was shocking and distressing. Like seeing a nun lifting her habit to reveal suspenders. You're smoking, accused Jessica. Marcia laughed and took another deep drag. I am smoking, Jessica. Occasionally, in times of stress, I smog. You're high, said Ben, tiredly, sadly. And Heather could hear in his voice the years of resigned disappointment suffered by an addict's relative. Ben was right. Marcia's eyes were glassy and her posture was strange and stiff, as if her head wasn't attached to her body and she was worried it would roll off. Marcia held up an empty smoothie glass. I have taken steps to reach a higher level of consciousness. Is Yao okay? Asked Heather. She tried to keep her tone respectful, even though her throat burned with hatred. Could we please see Yao? The screen of the camera seemed to be angled differently from the previous time. Marcia stood in front of a window in what looked like her office, although it was dark outside, so it was impossible to tell for sure. He is not your concern right now, said Marcia. It is time for you to present your cases for your clients. Will they live? Will they die? This is such a stimulating and thought-provoking exercise, I think. It's only 3 a.m., Marcia. Napoleon tapped the face of his watch. It's not dawn. You said we'd do this at dawn. Marcia lunged at the screen and pointed her cigarette at him. Guests should not wear watches during retreats. Napoleon reeled back. He held up his wrist. I've been wearing it the whole time. Nobody said I couldn't wear a watch. The watch should have been handed in with the other devices. Who was your wellness consultant? It's my fault, Marcia. I take responsibility for this. He unbuckled his watch. It was Yao, wasn't it? Screamed Marcia. She looked demonic. Her scream reverberated through the room. Flecks of her saliva dotted the screen. Jesus Christ, said Tony quietly. Zoe came to stand next to Heather and took her hand, something she hadn't done since she was a very little girl. It felt like no one breathed. Heather squeezed Zoe's hand, and for the first time since they'd been trapped down here, she experienced true dread. She thought of those times throughout her working life when the atmosphere in a labor ward went from focused to hyper-focused, because a mother's or a baby's life hung in the balance, and every member of staff in that room knew the next decision made had to be the right one. Except in this case, she had no training or experience to fall back upon. She longed to act, but she was impotent, and the overwhelming powerlessness reminded her of those nightmarish moments when she found Zack, her fingers looking for a pulse she already knew she wouldn't find. I am very disappointed in Yao, raged Marcia. That was an unacceptable mistake. I shall make sure HR knows. A note will go on his file. He will receive a formal letter of warning. Napoleon held up his watch by the strap and showed it to Marcia. I'm taking it off. Zoe squeezed Heather's hand convulsively. I'm sorry. It was my fault, said Napoleon in the slow, careful tone of someone placating a crazed gunman. I'm going to destroy it. He dropped the watch to the ground and went to put his foot over it. Marcia switched tone. Oh!
Stop being so dramatic, Napoleon. You could cut your foot.
She waved her cigarette about, gaily, as if she were in animated conversation at a party, a glass of wine in the other hand. Heather heard Zoe take a shaky breath, and the thought of her daughter's fear made her want to hurt this madwoman.
I am not the sort to become too obsessive about bureaucratic rules. I am flexible. I am big picture.
Masha took a long drag of her cigarette.
On the Myers-Briggs personality test, I am the commander. I think you will not be surprised to hear that.
This is not good. Lars peered up at the screen through splayed fingertips.
She's off with the fairies, murmured Tony. Nothing is forever, said Masha irrelevantly. Remember that. It's important. Now, who will be presenting first?
She looked around as if searching for something.
Does everyone have coffee? Not yet. Don't worry. Delilah will have it all under control.
She smiled and held out her arms as if she were sitting at the head of a conference table. Heather shuddered with a sudden sense of overwhelming fear. She's hallucinating. At that moment, Marsha's attention was caught by the cigarette between her fingers. Minutes passed, and she continued to stare at the cigarette.
What's she doing? Whispered Carmel.
It's the LSD, said Lars in a low voice. She can't believe she's never noticed the innate beauty of the cigarette.
Finally, Masha looked up.
Who is presenting first? She asked calmly.
She flicked the ash from her cigarette onto a windowsill.
I will, said Tony. Tony, excellent, said Masha. Who are you defending?
Carmel, said Tony. He gestured at Carmel, who made a strange, awkward movement, as if she couldn't decide whether to curtsy or hide behind Lars.
Go ahead, Tony.
Tony cleared his throat. He stood with his hands clasped and looked respectfully up at the screen.
I'm representing Carmel Schneider today. Carmel is 39 years old, divorced, with 4 young daughters. She is their primary caregiver. She is also very close to her older sister, Vanessa, and her parents, Mary and Raymond.
Masha looked bored. She sniffed. Tony's voice trembled.
Carmel's mother, Mary, is not in good health, and Carmel normally takes her to her doctor's appointments. Carmel says that she's just an ordinary person doing the best she can. But I think anyone bringing up 4 little girls on her own is pretty special.
He pulled nervously at the collar of his T-shirt as if he were adjusting a tie.
Carmel also volunteers at her local library teaching English to refugees. She does this once a week. She's been doing this since she was 18, which I think is very impressive.
He clasped his hands in front of him.
Thank you.
Masha yawned theatrically.
Oh, is that it?
Tony lost his temper.
For Christ's sake, she's a young mother. What else do you want to hear? Obviously, she doesn't deserve to die.
But where is your USP? Said Masha.
USP?
asked Tony blankly.
You've forgotten the basics, Tony. What is your unique selling proposition? What makes Carmel unique and special?
Well, said Tony desperately, she is very special because...
I also wonder why you did not begin with a basic analysis of strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. It's not rocket science, people. And visual aids. I see no visual aids. A simple PowerPoint slideshow would have helped support your argument.
Heather made eye contact with Napoleon. What do we do? She saw the confusion and fear on his face, and that made her panic grow, because if Napoleon had no answers, they were in trouble. She thought of those times in hospital emergency waiting rooms with Zach when they realized they were dealing with a numbskull of a triage nurse, how they would exchange looks over Zach's head, and how they both knew exactly what to do and say to act as advocates for their child. But they had never dealt with this dizzying lack of logic.
I'm sorry, said Tony humbly. Obviously, PowerPoint would have helped support my argument.
Yes. Sorry doesn't cut it. Snarled Marcia.
Could I go next? A loud voice cut unexpectedly through Marcia's. Heather saw with a start that it was Carmel, her chin lifted, her eyes unflinching.
I've prepared a strategic analysis on behalf of Zoe Marconi, and what we should be doing, going forward. And I'd really like your buy-in on this, Marcia.
Marcia's face smoothed. She lifted a hand.
Go ahead, Carmel.
Carmel strode to the center of the room and straightened an imaginary suit jacket, even though she was wearing leggings and a pink singlet top emblazoned with the sequined word Hawaii.
I know you wanted me to really drill down on this, Marcia, and think outside the box.
It was hard to reconcile this woman of such confidence with the Carmel who had just a few hours earlier begged so pathetically to go home. Now you could practically see her power suit. Was she an actress? Or was she calling on the memory of a previous profession? Whatever it was impressive.
Absolutely.
Marcia made a brisk chopping motion with the side of her hand.
This is more like it. We need to push the envelope. This is very impressive, Carmel.
It could almost be amusing if it weren't so terrifying. The way I see it, we've got a real window of opportunity here to leverage Zoe's core competencies, said Carmel, and achieve best practice solutions.
Oh, well done, whispered Frances.
That's right, Marcia nodded. We should always be aiming for best practice.
It was bizarre to see how well she responded to this meaningless corporate speak, like a baby responds to the sound of its mother's voice.
The question is this, said Marcia shrewdly. Does it align with our corporate values?
Exactly, said Carmel. And once we have all our ducks in a row, we need to ask this. Is it scalable?
Is it?
Said Marcia. Exactly, said Carmel. So what we're looking for is...
She faltered.
Synergies, murmured Lars. Synergies, said Carmel with relief.
Synergies, repeated Marcia dreamily, as if she was saying, Paris in spring.
So, to sum up, we need a synergistic solution that dovetails.
I've heard all I need to hear, said Marcia briskly. Action that, please, Carmel.
Will do, said Carmel. Marcia stubbed out her cigarette on the windowsill behind her. She leaned back against the window.
Welcome to Tranquillum House.
Oh, dear God, thought Heather. We've lost her again. Marcia smiled. No one smiled back. Heather saw that every face in the room was slack with exhaustion and despair, like the face of a woman who has innocently prepared a natural birth plan, created a playlist, and who, after 30 hours of labor, is told that she must now have an emergency cesarean.
Marcia said, I promise you this. In 10 days, you will not be the person you are now.
Fuck, said Jessica. Fuck, fuck, fuck.
It's just the drugs, said Lars. She doesn't know what she's saying.
That's not the problem, said Ben. She doesn't know what she's doing.
Marcia lowered her head and put her fingertips to the neckline of her dress.
We will all do push-ups now, she said. Push-ups are the perfect functional integrated resistance exercise. It's the only exercise that works every single muscle in your body. 20 push-ups. Now.
No one moved.
Why do you ignore me?
Marcia jabbed a finger at the screen. Push-ups. Now.
Or I will be forced to take action.
What action could she possibly take? But they didn't wait to find out. They dropped to the floor like soldiers.
Heather tried to lift and lower her tired, hungry body in a parallel line as Marcia counted out loud,
1, 2, 3. Drop those hips. No harbor bridges.
Was she still in her hallucinogenic state, where she seemingly believed they all worked for her? Did she plan to kill them all?
Heather felt a sudden, wild panic. She'd brought her daughter to this place. Zoe's life could rest in the hands of this mad, drug-affected woman. She looked around her. Frances did girl push-ups on her knees. Jessica cried as she too gave up and went from her toes to her knees. Tony, the former athlete, dripped sweat as he did perfect form push-ups at twice the speed of almost everyone else, in spite of having just popped his shoulder. Heather noted that her own darling husband kept pace.
18, 19, 20. Relax. Excellent.
Heather collapsed onto her stomach and looked up. Marcia had pressed her face so close to the screen that all they could see was a magnified image of her nose, mouth, and chin.
I'm just wondering, said the disembodied mouth. Can you smell it yet?
It was Napoleon who answered in the calm, gentle voice he would use for a toddler.
Smell what, Marcia? The smoke.